We want to welcome each one as we continue our studies on godly homes in a wicked world. We're gathered before the throne of God in a unique way when we assemble for study and worship in this way, and there's nothing more important we could do, and every moment that we could spend before His throne should draw us closer to Him, and I hope the service will have that effect on each one of us tonight. I want to acknowledge the presence of Brother Danny McKibben and Brother Steve Lee that have done a good work through the years, and it's a little bit unusual, four of us here tonight that have done work in the Philippines. And then I want to thank Sister Barbara, Sister Flossie for our supper tonight, and Brother Chester for our lunch today. And I want to make an observation about that. We are sometimes inspired by the examples of young people, and it's good for us to mention that from time to time. For instance, where I live, we recently had a gospel meeting. We have young men that play on the high school football team, and on Friday night, they miss their game to be in the service. That's an inspiration. We have young ladies on the softball team. They never let a softball game interfere with their worship. But I want to tell you about the older people that are faithful, because I've noticed that since I was a teenager. When you watch people in their latter years, faithful, steady, consistent to attend the worship, I want you to know that's a powerful lesson to every human being if we would open our eyes and pay attention to it. In other words, if they can do that, why can't the rest of us do that? So I thank you and salute you for the example that you're setting. And I know they are not the only ones. There are others. There will be an opportunity for your questions. If you think of a question, make a note of it and feel free to participate in that part of our study. And we're going to study Solomon's Song of Marital Love. The Song of Solomon celebrates the joy and security of committed love in marriage. In chapter 7, verse 10, Shulamite girl that he married said, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me." She was filled with joy as she shared the love of marriage with her husband. As this book begins, chapter 1, verse 1, it said the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And the meaning of that is that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs, and he never wrote a song more beautiful or more unique than this song. This song celebrates passionate love in the context of marriage. When our brethren debate the Muslims, they will say this book is pornographic because it does focus on passionate love. And what they overlook is this: God and not Satan is the origin of our passionate sexual nature. It is a gift and a blessing when shared in the context of marriage. And there's not one thing pornographic about this book, and I think you'll see that even tonight. Very beautiful book. Solomon courted and married a young lady from Shunem, which is a small place in a rural part of northern Israel. She is called the Shulamite. Well, that was in the days of his youth. Now, you know, in later years, that political marriages marred his character, but not at this stage that we're going to be studying about tonight. What is the value of studying this unusual book? Well, the first thing, it's a very beautiful story of love and marriage, and something that adds to the interest of the story: you are in this book. You and I have lived this same story. You will see that tonight. But the second thing is, we could learn to cultivate true love in marriage by lessons that stand out in this book. We can learn to improve our homes, our marriages, by the study of this good book. Well, let's first tell the beautiful story of love and marriage in the Song of Solomon. The first scene pictures love's passion in the stage of courtship from chapter 1, verse 2 to chapter 2, verse 7. Solomon and the Shulamite share and openly express their admiration and affection one for another. So we begin in verse 2 when she says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine." Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. Now this story is told in poetry, and poetry is not like prose, of course. A lot of figurative language and a lot of symbols taken from nature as we go through this. It never stops to tell us who is speaking, or at least only on one or two rare occasions. It is only by the gender-specific pronouns that you will know who is speaking. When verse 2 said, "Let him kiss me," then who's speaking? Well, not Solomon, but the Shulamite, of course. And then she was expressing the joy of him showing affection to her. And she said, "It is more refreshing than wine." You should know that the word wine is used in two ways in the Bible. It's used of intoxicating drink, which is destructive. But it's also used of the fresh juice of the grape, which is simply a very refreshing drink. And so, she says that just as you're refreshed by a delicious wine, I am refreshed and lifted up when Solomon shows affection. Now, verse 3 is very important because we're just beginning the book, and I want you to notice the emphasis on the good name of Solomon. This is not a book about pornography. She praises his good name and said the harem, the court, recognizes his good character and his good reputation. His name doesn't have the stench of immorality upon it. His name has the fragrance of an ointment, the smell of a perfume, or an aftershave, or you just think of something that has a good smell. And so the book emphasizes the importance of godly character in Solomon, and then in the Shulamite, we'll notice that too. Now, as the story goes along in verses 15 to 17, they openly express compliments and praise to each other. In verse 15, "Behold, thou art fair, my love, behold, thou art fair, thou hast dove's eyes." God made a lot of beautiful things in nature. Did you ever notice the eyes of doves? Soft and tender. "And your eyes," he said, "remind me of a dove's eyes." She responds in verse 16, "Behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant. Also our bed is green. The beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters of fir." Now keep in mind, poetry. What she's saying is, "I'm so delighted with our relationship, I could be happy if we were married and our house was the green grass and the trees over our head. And I want to remind you that when you were courting somebody, you felt the same way. And so did I." We're in this story. All right, as it continues here in chapter 2, 1 and 2, as this love continues to develop, she at times will express insecurity. There are several passages like that scattered through the book. And a wise Solomon has to learn how to give her more of a feeling of security. She said in chapter 2, verse 1, "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." Now what that means is, I'm just like a little tiny flower that grows in the rural areas where she came from, and I'm out of place in the great courts and the palace of a king, and he has his harem here, these women that have never had the sun touch their skin, all white and perfumed, and I've had to work out of doors, and my skin is dark, and I feel like a lily among thorns, a lily of the valley. Now, here's how he answers that. She is diminishing herself. And he answers, "As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters." I want you to notice, he did not agree with her. Men, don't always agree with your wife. When your wife says, "I think I'm getting too fat," don't say, "Yes, dear, I agree." Solomon didn't say, "Yes, you're just a rose of Sharon. You're just a little rural flower." He said, "Well, maybe you are a rose and a lily, but among thorns. You are more beautiful than all the ladies of my court." And so, what he's doing is reinforcing a sense of security in her. Now in chapter 2, verse 7, she says something that will be repeated throughout the book. It's one of the themes. I charge you, O you daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hands of the field, that you stir not up nor await my love till he please. And the meaning of that is simply this. I charge the ladies of the court by all things that are beautiful and tender, like the young fawns, let love grow in its own time and its own way. Just like flowers have to grow in their own time and way, and small animals grow in their own time and way. Did you know the relationship between a man and a woman has to grow in its own time and in its own way? You can't push it, you can't pull it, you can't force it. It has to grow in its own time. And we have to learn a sense of patience about that. That's one of the themes of the book. Well, we have the second scene. Chapter 2, verse 8. Chapter 3, verse 5. I'm not touching every verse, of course, but we just want to get an overview, and maybe you can read the book as you have time at home. The springtime of their love was followed by anxious searching. And that's going to be pictured here. In chapter 2, 10 to 13, their young love is flourishing like nature flourishes in the springtime. So look at chapter 2, verse 10. My beloved spake and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Let's go together, for the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle, that's the turtle dove, is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Now, as you think back, when you courted your mate, there were times that you felt like it's springtime. Yes, you had that sense that the birds are singing the beautiful songs that God created them to sing, and the flowers and the other plants are showing their beauty, and I feel like that I'm a part of that springtime. And so that's what is being expressed. That's what he said to her. Well, notice this then. In chapter 3, in verses 1 to 5, it seems all is growing and developing well, but she has a dream. And this dream is a signal something's going on in the relationship. She searches for him and can't find him. Finally, she catches up with him and she will hold him fast. By night on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. And this is in her sleep now, dreaming. I will arise now and go about the city in the streets and in the broad ways. I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen that go about the city found me, of whom I said, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? You've had dreams like this. I have too. I dream about somebody that's close to me or dear to me, and I can't find that person. And I'm frantic, and I'm looking, and I'm searching. And she bumped into the police and said, I'm searching for him. Where is he? And they don't know either. You ever had a dream somewhat like that? Now that tells us something is happening. They're drifting apart. If you ask me why, I don't know. And I think the reason the writer doesn't tell, there's a lot of reasons that can happen. A relationship that seems to be progressing can sometimes have setbacks, and there are 1,000 different reasons. But anyway, let's see what happened in verse 4. It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her that conceived me. Notice I held him and would not let him go. So something has happened and it's taken a good turn again, and they're close again, and the relationship will continue to progress. Now here's the signal we get there. The experience of love as it grows includes the challenge of constant seeking and finding. Every relationship has its ups and its downs. I think I found the right person, then I'm not sure. We drift apart, but then we draw back together. Something happens where we experience some sense of alienation. But something happens so that we're reconciled again. I feel a little bit confused. I'm just not sure. But the next day, it's crystal clear. This is the one I need to pursue. This is the one I want to marry. And you are in that passage. I know good and well you are. I am too. I look back on that courtship with my wife. There were times everything was progressing like a springtime. And then there were times that I'm wondering if it's ever going to make it. Yeah, we've all been there. That's just part of the nature of it. Then, notice verse 5 again, I charge you, O you daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hands of the field, that you stir not up nor awake my love till he please. This story will not be instant in its outcome, and love is not something that is just spontaneous and full grown in a few days. And so she's learning by passing through these experiences. I charge you by everything beautiful and tender, we must let love grow in its own time, in its own way. Think of it like this. God designed the natural order that way. Plants have to grow in their own time, in their own way. But you know what? Human relationships are exactly like that too. They have to grow in their own time and in their own way. Now the key is learning how to help the crops to grow. And the key in relationships is learning how do I make it grow. And this book is giving us insight about that. Well, the third scene, chapter 3, verse 6 to 5 and 1. We will have a picture of the royal wedding. And after that, Solomon praises the beauty of his wife. And she invites him into the garden of her love. Notice in chapter 3 here, verses 9 and 10. Friends are now speaking as they share the joys of the wedding day. King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon, the finest cedars of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it purple, and in the midst of thereof being paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. So Solomon honored the occasion of their wedding by presenting his bride this beautiful new carriage that will bring them to the ceremony. I told you you were in that story. Did you give your wife or husband a gift when you got married? You sure did. And I sure did. And they sure did. And so, we don't have time to read that paragraph, but it pictures that happy day. Now in chapter 4, 1 to 7, Solomon woos her with passionate praise of her beauty. Chapter 4, verse 1, Behold, thou art fair, my love, behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. So your eyes are beautiful and attractive to me. Your hair is beautiful. When he speaks of the flock of goats, think about a high mountain and you're observing late in the evening and they're bringing the flocks down and they follow the trails and they just flow down the mountainside. And he said, when I look at your hair, I think of things like that. And he goes on praising her physical beauty. And there's not one thing out of order or pornographic about that. God created the beauty of the wife, and the husband ought to be able to admire that beauty. But go down to verse 7. Thou art all fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. And he said, in my eyes, you don't have a single fault. There's a lot of wisdom in that. Now, everybody has a fault in a literal sense. I know that, and he knew that. But in the sense of expressing our love, we should be able to say, I selected you and I married you because I believe you're absolutely the perfect and right person for me. I should be able to say that honestly. If I couldn't say that, I shouldn't marry her. All right, so the wedding day. And then in chapter 4, verse 12 to 5:1, Solomon says, you are like a beautiful oasis, a garden in an oasis. And she says, yes, and I want to invite you to enjoy the fruits of that oasis. Now notice how this is going to start. Because I say again, this is not a pornographic book. in your wildest imagination. Look how this starts. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Look at the words enclosed, shut up, sealed. And what he's saying is, every man cannot approach this lady that has such a godly character. Then he goes ahead to say, thy plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, camphor with spikenard, spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. They lived in a land where there were places that you had barren territory, but there would be an oasis, and beautiful plants could flourish. And he said, darling, you are my oasis in a barren world. Now notice her reaction. Verse 16, awake, she is speaking, awake, O north wind, and come thou south. Blow upon my garden, and the spices thereof may flow out. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits. So she said, dear, if I'm an oasis garden, I invite you into that garden. And then I want you to notice my garden and his garden. She said, my garden, myself, is your garden. I want to be yours, and I want to be with you, and I want you to be at my side. You will notice this love is exclusive. My garden, his garden. There's just two of them. And yet there are people who think that the Bible is devoid of expressing that love can be passionate. There are worldly people that think you have to get out and run with the world to find the real joys of life and to explore the joys of your sexual nature. And that's an absolute lie from Satan. God created us with passion and even our sexual nature, and God wants that to be free and inviting and giving and sharing, just like you're reading in the Bible right now, but exclusive to the husband and the wife. And you see that in this story. Well, let's notice then the fourth scene, love's reconciliation. Now they're married, but in chapter 5, verse 2 to chapter 6, verse 3, we learn that marital love includes a seeking and finding process even after marriage. There are times of alienation and times of reconciliation. All right, notice then, chapter 5, beginning here in verse 2, I sleep, but my heart waketh. So she's dreaming again. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. For my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. So picture that he's been on a long journey. She's dreaming this. And he comes in late at night, knocking at the door. Dear, I'm home. I have missed you so much. Please open. I'm just ready to see you. Stirs and begins to the dream. And so verse 3, here's what she's thinking. I have put off my coat. How shall I put it on? I have washed my feet. How shall I defile them? My land, Solomon, don't you know you're waking me up in the middle of the night? I've already taken off my regular clothes. I'm in my night clothes. I've washed myself. I'm in the bed. And you want me to get up? What is the matter with you? Now look at his tender, fervent plea. Open my sister, my love, my dove. He really pours out his heart to her. And her reaction is, why do you bother me at the most inconvenient time? Something going on in this marriage. And you can relate to it because you've been there and done that. And so have I. I've been poring over my sermon, and I've just about got it right. And here comes my wife. Can you change the light bulb in the kitchen? I can't get anything done. And I want to say, don't you know I'm busy? Been there, done that? Yes, we all have. It's just part of the nature of it. But sometimes that leaves a wound. Now she gave it a second thought in verse 6. I opened to my beloved. She rolled out of the bed finally. But my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. Oh, my soul fainted when he spake. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. Now, she treated him like an inconvenience, and the damage was done. So in the dream, he is some way alienated, and I can't find him. And now I'm heartsick when I think about how he poured out his heart to me, and I did this to him. Oh, she said, my soul failed when I thought about his voice. And then she said, I did seek him, and I reached out to him, but it was too late. And my efforts failed, and I just felt alone. I called out, and nothing but an echo, not even anyone to help me solve my problem. They're alienated. If you say why, I don't know why. I tell you there are 1,000 reasons such things happen. But now, dropping down to verse 10, because her friends said, well, why are you so frantically looking for him? She begins to think what he means to her. My beloved is white and ruddy. That means he's top-notch handsome. The chiefest among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold. His locks are bushy and black as a raven. And she begins to describe him from head to foot, just like earlier he described her from head to foot, with great admiration. Can't read all of it, but coming down to verse 16, she concluded, his mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely or handsome, we would say. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. So, back in chapter 4, verse 7, he found her perfect for him. Remember that? I don't find any flaw in her. And now she finds him to be perfect for her. At first he was an inconvenience, but now he's a prize, the best of 10,000. Look at that. All right. Now, in chapter 6, 2 and 3, they've been reconciled. We're not told how. And it happens in many different ways. But she yields herself to his care with a greater sense of security now. She said in chapter 6, verse 2, my beloved has gone down into his garden to the bed of spices to feed in the gardens and to gather the lilies. I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. He feedeth among the lilies. So in the dream, there's an alienation. She feels frantic. She says, you're an inconvenience to me. And so, in time, she reconsidered. And she said, I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. Now look at the process. A separation occurred. She had time to think about it. She had regrets as she reflected and reevaluated. Her attitude is changing. Then, the next step here, a reconciliation occurred. And there's a growing sense of security. I am my beloved. I have invited him into my garden. My beloved is mine. There is a mutual relationship between us. We are committed to one another. I am my beloved. My beloved is mine. Do you see that committed relationship? And two makes a couple, but three makes a crowd. I am my beloved. There's just two of them. My beloved is mine. There's still just two of them. And so, there was a reconciliation that occurred. Let's go to the fifth scene. Chapter 6, verse 4. Chapter 8, verse 4. The two lovers are now captivated and enthralled with each other. In chapter 6, noticing at verse 8, Solomon said, there are 80 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. I have a great harem, I'm a great king. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. I don't care how many there are in my harem. You're the only one in my heart. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and blessed her. Yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. I admire her, and everyone that knows her admires her. And however many children and daughters her mother could have, she and she alone will always be the right person for me. Now, folks, we need to be able to say things like that. I don't mean we have to recite it as poetry. This is telling a story in poetry. But we need to be able to say it We need to say it again and again, you are the right one for me. We need to find ways to convey to our mate that I'm not roving and seeking someone else. I'm thankful to have you. And I'm not interested in finding anyone else. He praises her as his one and only. Praise your mate as your one and only. We need that. And that's how relationships become stronger. And she reacted by inviting him into the garden of her love again to enjoy her delicious fruit. Look at verse 10. Chapter 7, verse 10. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. I'm thankful to know that he wants me and desires me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourish, whether the tender grape appear, and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give my loves. The mandrakes give a smell, and at our gates are all manner of pleasant fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for thee, O my beloved. That might remind you of a passage we read a few minutes ago. When they were beginning, there was a springtime in their relationship. Now they've been married, they've had ups and downs, but look, here is another springtime in their relationship. He complimented her, she feels valued. She feels secure in that atmosphere. She feels my husband wants me and not someone else. And so she said, I want him in my garden. There's another springtime. Did you know we can have many springtimes as we continue to live and love? Springtime is here. Come and taste all of my fruits. She said, new and old. Well, love must grow in its own time, in its own way. The last time that we have it is chapter 8, verse 4. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake my love until he please. I charge you by everything beautiful and tender, let love grow in its own time, in its own way. She's learned that by living it. And we must learn it as well. Well, then the sixth scene, the last scene, love's great security in this marriage. Solomon and his bride express mutual love and commitment. Look here at verses 6 and 7, chapter 8. Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm. Wealthy people back in those times, just like you have an identification card, they had a small object with carving on it, and they could press that on soft clay or wax, and when it would harden, that was their signature. You don't want to lose the seal. So they wore it around their neck on a cord or a chain or a necklace of some kind, and it laid against their heart. She said, I hope you will look upon me as a seal, and it lies upon your heart or upon your arm. Then love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Now what she's saying there is a jealous, protective love in a good sense. And it should be as strong and unyielding as death itself. Death has a finality. My love for my wife should have an absolute finality. It's not going away. It's not going to waver. Just like you can't call back the dead, I'm not going to call back or undo the love that is committed to my mate. And she said, that's the love we have. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame. When someone important dies, sometimes we put what we call an eternal flame. And she said, our love is like a flame, a fire placed by God in our hearts, and that flame should burn forever. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. Our love can withstand all the storms of life. That's what she said. And this love is not for sale, and this love cannot be bought. This love is priceless. And what a true statement that is. Well, in verses 8 to 10, there's an interesting footnote. Her brothers kind of doubt her. She's the youngest. And they doubt her maturity. But she affirms, I have proven my maturity. Look at verse 8. We have a little sister. In their eyes, she will always be the little sister. She hath no breast. That's just a way of saying little sister, not grown up. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken of? Is she ready for marriage? If she be a wall, we will build her a palace of silver. A wall. If she is strong like a wall, in her moral character, we will honor her and adorn her with silver. But look how the verse continued. And if she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. A door is a place where you can easily go in and go out. Now, if she's weak in character, any man can approach her and touch her and even have sexual relations with her. And if we think that's our sister, we will build a wall and we will protect her from herself because she's not mature. Well, it's like older brothers to somewhat look at a younger sister in that way. But here's the most interesting part of the passage, verse 10. She would have something to say about this. I am a wall, and my breasts like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. Now listen, friend. This affirms her strength of character. She knows who she is. No, sir, I'm not a door. I'm a wall. And this is a vital part of her total beauty. This book begins by emphasizing moral character, and this book ends by emphasizing moral character. When I read that verse, I always think of my mother. When we were teenagers and beginning to date, we would ask her, Mama, did you date? Well, yes, she said, I did. She said, in fact, I was very popular. Really? Well, what happened? Well, she said, sometime the boys got too fresh with me. Really? What happened then? She said, I slept the fire out of them. And they named me the old battle axe. She knew who she was. That's why I haven't forgotten that. My mother was signaling the young men, I like to be with you and have friends and dates, but I want you to know who I am. I'm a wall. And don't you think you can enter like a door? That's exactly what the Shulamite said. Well, let's just take a few moments to think back on what we've read. Let's learn about cultivating true love in marriage. I think you would agree with me, one of the outstanding points, love has its own way to grow. That was repeated. Chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4. Now, why do you think it's repeated? Because it's important. Love has to grow. That's a word that means it requires time. It cannot be rushed. It cannot be pushed. It cannot be bribed. You cannot demand it. You cannot intimidate a person to win this love. You cannot force a person. Just to make a very simple illustration, I still remember when I first met my wife at college, I was immediately attracted to her. I not only thought she was beautiful, she had a good reputation, and I wanted to date her, and I had to kind of get in line. Now, what if I had jumped ahead of a lad and grabbed her by the arm and said, I'm pretty sure I want to marry you. Let's hurry this up. Do you think that would have worked? She'd have probably called for the police, and I'd have been sitting in a jail cell. Love has to grow. Now, the key is, how does it grow? And you have to learn that lesson. You're not born with that knowledge. It grows in its own time, in its own way. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hands of the field, that you stir not up nor awake my love till it please, until it's ready. And then it will grow. It will grow in its own time, in its own way. Well, how does it grow? By unselfish character. That's how you will win the love of someone. Not by thinking, me, me, me. I want, I want, I want. But genuinely seeking the welfare of other people. Not what's in it for me, but what can I do to be considerate of others? How can I show kindness to this person? How can I be courteous to this person? Not as a front, not as a line, but because that's who I want to be. Did you know that's how love grows? That's exactly how love grows. It doesn't grow by someone focusing the light on myself. Am I being noticed? Am I being pampered? Does that person give enough attention to me? I might be interested in you if you really give enough attention to me. That's not how love grows. Love grows by patience. Not I want what I want, and I want it when I want it, and I want it right now. That's not how love grows. In fact, that's a good way to destroy love. And some begin in the right way, but after they're married, and especially men tend to do this, then I want what I want when I want it, and I want it right now. And this house is going to have trouble if I don't get what I want. I'm the head of my house. No, you're about to destroy your relationship. You haven't learned how love grows. Number two, how does love grow? Godly character is the foundation. I repeat, godly character is the foundation of true love. Solomon and the Shulamite maintained a godly character in courtship and marriage. They did not live together before marriage. And I repeat, they did not live together before marriage. I don't care how many celebrities are doing this and how many well-known famous people are doing this. That's not the foundation of true love. That's a recipe for utter disaster. But in this book, you will see, chapter 1, verse 3, thy name is as ointment or perfume, something that has a very beautiful fragrance. And chapter 4, verse 12, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. And that means she held her moral purity as a gift to her husband. And that's how love grows. It's based on the foundation of godly character. And I don't think we can forget when she said, I am a wolf. We need to know who we are. That I'm a Christian, not a little bit, not sometimes, not on Sunday, but I'm a child of God, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and that includes when I'm dating and when somebody's courting me. And I'm not ashamed for them to know I am a wall. You know what? That's the foundation to find true love someday. Well, this godly character requires respect for God and for each other as made in the image of God. If you look upon the person that you're courting or the person you're married to, this is an individual made in the image of God. You cannot speak unkindly to that person. Not as long as you keep that focus, you can't. You think about that. Can you abuse someone while you're thinking this person is made in the image of God? You cannot. And so that godly character, respecting and reverencing God and respecting people made in the image of God, that's the foundation of what makes love grow. Now that means we must avoid conduct which erodes moral character. And folks, we live in a time where that is an all-out war. And even when I was young, it was a war. Most of my friends went drinking, then they had the prom, and on prom night they got a room at a motel, and all of that stuff. You think that's the foundation to have a true, to share true married love? It destroys that foundation. It destroys it. Running around in shorts and showing off your thighs and then no backless dresses and then showing your breast by having a dress that are wearing what a cheerleader wears where you can see her underpants and jumping up and down and kicking her legs in front of people. I want to tell you something. I know that makes them popular. They were popular when I was in high school too. But that's not the foundation for true married love. You need to know that. I need to know that. Godly character is the foundation. Coarse, profane, abusive language is not the foundation. And I got bit by that bug when I played high school football and all my buddies cursed and swore. I had to show I'm a big boy too. And then the time came that I realized this is destructive. And I need to stop. And it wasn't easy to stop. Satan deceives us. He gets a hook in us. And it destroys moral character if we don't turn it around. Alcohol, illegal drugs, and misusing legal drugs destroys moral character. In order for me to find the right person, does anybody remember the lesson last night? In order for me to find the right person, what must I first do? I must be the right person in moral character. Lascivious dress, lascivious entertainment, pornography, and fornication do not prepare us for true love, but destroy the potential for true love. We learned this lesson. Maturity is essential. The book touches on that lesson. Part of the point of chapter 8, verses 8 to 10, marriage requires maturity. When the brother said, we're not so sure if she's mature enough for marriage, and if she's like a door, if she gives me an easy access, if she doesn't have that strong moral character, we must enclose her with boards of cedar. We've got to put strict limits here and restrict her because she's a danger to herself. What that is saying is maturity and character is essential. Now, if she's a wall, if she has that maturity and strength of character, we will build upon her a palace of silver. We will honor her and respect her as a mature woman. Yes, she is ready to marry. And again, I love that statement that she made. Men and women alike can make this statement, I am a wall. In other words, I am not easy. She said, my breasts were like towers. That just means I'm fully mature. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. And that says Solomon saw my mature moral character. He was attracted to me not just for my physical beauty, but for my moral character. Let me tell you, folks, your hope of a good marriage is someone seeing you as a person of strong moral character and being drawn to you for that purpose. The physical side plays a role, and I know that very well. And I consider my Donna as the most beautiful woman that I know. Yes, I understand that's part of it. But if the person you're interested in does not have the strong moral character, you need to find someone else as fast as you can. Well, what about that maturity? How do you recognize it? What are the signs of a mature man or a mature woman? Putting God first in all the decisions of life. That shows maturity. When it's time to go off to college, we look for a sound church so that we can worship God. That's a sign of maturity. When we're dating and the young man refuses to come to church services with us, we're finished with him and we find someone else. That's a sign that you're putting God first. When you're thinking about what kind of job you're going to prepare yourself for, and you don't want a job that makes it virtually impossible for you to worship God. And you don't want a job where you've got to be dishonest to succeed. In other words, everything you do, you think first about God. That is maturity. Being faithful in public worship and godly in private life is maturity. I admire the young men where I worship who missed that Friday night football game and they're on the team. They were at the gospel meeting. That is developing maturity. The problem is when you start saying, well, we had a game, I couldn't come. The next night we had homework, I couldn't come. The next night we had a tournament, I couldn't come. I'm going to tell you, this is a recipe for failure in spiritual things. It's not maturity. But look at this. Some people can be faithful in public worship, but they're not godly in their private life. That's not maturity. You should be the same person when you worship and when you go home. When you go home and when you come to worship. That's maturity. Maturity means we're ready to accept the responsibility of being a husband. Not just having a woman at my side, but I have responsibilities. The responsibilities of a wife. Not just saying, look, I got married. I got beautiful pictures. Well, that part's good, but can you accept the responsibilities? Being ready to accept the responsibility of parenthood. Well, we're not going to have children for the first 10 years. Well, I'm not saying it's a sin to make a decision like that, but I got news. Some little fella or some little girl can show up next year, and you didn't know that was going to happen. And so are you ready to be a parent? Are you ready for sober, serious, godly responsibility toward a child? That's a sign of maturity. Being good stewards of our money and our material possessions is a good sign of maturity. So we need to think about maturity because it is essential. Then I hope you saw this as one of the outstanding lessons of the book. We should express our love, our care, our compliments, and our admiration. You are the right one. You are the only one in my eyes. Remember how we read that several times? And we need to say that not only when we're dating, but all the way through our married life. In chapter 4, verse 7, you are beautiful. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. I need to say things like that to my wife. Chapter 5, verse 10, my lover is radiant and ruddy. He's very handsome, outstanding among 10,000. A wife needs to express that I'm still glad that I'm married to you. You don't have to speak it in poetry, and I can't do that either, but there are ways we can convey these concepts. Chapter 6, verse 9, my dove, my perfect one is unique, the only daughter of her mother, the favorite. So over and over, you find the expressing of love and care and compliments and admiration. We don't need to be like the fellow that told his wife how much he loved her the day they got married, and 10 years later she asked, why don't you ever tell me you love me? You told me the day we got married. And he said, well, listen, I told you when we got married, if I change my mind, I'll tell you. No, we need to reaffirm. We need to open our mouth and express, I still love you. You are still the right one. I thank God that you're my mate. We need to create an atmosphere for renewed passion in the relationship. In chapter 2, 10 to 13, my lover spake and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over. Here was a springtime. We need many springtimes. How does that happen? We need to take a day to do special things together. We need to go out to eat if it were that, or maybe take a short vacation, but giving time and attention to each other. Chapter 4, verse 9. One glance of your eyes took my heart. I'm captivated by you. That's what he said. He wasn't ashamed to say that to his wife. Chapter 4, 16 to 5, 1. Remember about the oasis? And then she said, let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. He wasn't ashamed to say, you are my oasis garden. She wasn't ashamed to say, I want you in my garden. Another thing, we need to be patient with cycles of seeking and finding. Love is not all mountaintop experience. There are cycles, ups and downs, and we have to let love grow stronger by passing through the cycles. In chapter 2, verse 14, he said, my beloved became like a dove in the clefts of the rock. She withdrew like a bird hiding in the rocks. But he coaxed her and reassured her of his love. There may be times that your mate will be hiding in the cleft of the rock. Do you scream at her? Well, what's the matter with you? That is what some men do. Or do you offer reassurance? And dear, I know something is wrong. How can I help? These are lessons we should be learning. In chapter 3, 1 to 5, she dreams of searching for him. There was some setback or insecurity, but she finds him. They conducted themselves in some way that they were able to patch up their difference. But you know, after they married in chapter 5, she had a similar dream. He sought her. She said, you're inconvenient. And they had some separation for a while. But later they were reconciled. And that tells me they were loving to deal with those cycles. They were learning that. We have to learn that. In fact, we should embrace it. We should embrace the challenge of working to strengthen that marital relationship. When you come home and your wife has been crying, instead of saying, you're always crying and I'm sick and tired of it, what's the matter now? That's not going to help anything. But showing some sympathy and asking why, what can I do to help? And understanding when you solve it today, a month later, it may come again. And instead of dragging up all the past history, deal with it again. The cycles go up and the cycles go down. Reconciliation requires reflection. When you're having some alienation, step back and reflect. Step back and ask questions instead of making accusations. That's just like you. You're always that way. I'm tired of this. No, how about if you step back and ask, why could she be feeling that way? Why could he be feeling that way? And guess what? Instead of evaluating the other person, what if you look in the mirror and evaluate self? Because you can't change your mate. I cannot change Donna, and Donna cannot change Ron. You know who I can change? I can change the fella I see in the mirror, and that's all I can change. And I should pay attention to that when there's some alienation. How can I be a better husband? How can I do my job better? We need to reflect about making adjustments. I can't force my wife to adjust. I can adjust myself in certain ways, though. And we need to be able to say, I'm sorry. You know, one of the problems of men, and I'm not saying men are always the issue, but I want to say something about men. Men suffer from the lockjaw disease. You know what the lockjaw disease is? When it's time to say, I'm sorry, it comes out like, I'm sorry. You can't hardly tell he said anything close to it. Because we have too much male ego sometimes. And I'm seriously telling you, we've got to learn to be patient with these cycles. It's part of the nature of love and marriage. And if I can't say I'm sorry and mean it, I'm going to have a lot of setbacks and heartaches in my marriage. Then we must finally do this, and I'll emphasize the word atmosphere when I say this. We must build an atmosphere. An atmosphere of surroundings of security, loyalty. We share that loyalty, fidelity to each other, unquestioned fidelity, peace, working, striving to be at peace in order to have a happy, harmonious home. That's the atmosphere we need. Each mate contributes to these bonds of love. Love grows where there is an atmosphere of security and loyalty and fidelity and peace. Now I have to do my part. My mate has to do her part. It doesn't help to berate my mate. What helps is for me to work harder and harder to do my part. Remember chapter 2, 3, and 4. I say remember, we really didn't have time to read that one. But she said, I feel like when I'm with him, I'm sitting in the shade of an apple tree and I can enjoy the fruit of that tree. Now think about that for a minute. That's a picture of someone who experienced a sense of security. I'm sitting under a tree that shades me and feeds me. I feel secure. And she said, he honored me with a banquet. His banner over me was love. I should find many ways to put a banner over my wife that says how much I love her. And he said in chapter 2, verse 15, when she kind of withdrew in the rocks, he said, we need to guard lest little foxes spoil the vines. Little foxes will run in the springtime among the grapevines and damage the young grapes. And sometimes, brethren, our problem in our relationship is not adultery and drunkenness, not big elephant issues, but little foxes are running around. What are the foxes? We don't ever compliment each other. We don't ever say I'm sorry to each other. We don't take time for each other. Take time to pray together or read a chapter in the Bible or go out to eat or what have you. But we just don't take time for each other. And did you know sometimes then we wake up alienated and we can't figure out why? And Solomon said, darling, we must not let the little foxes spoil the vines. We must work and work and work to maintain this mutual and exclusive love. We all know that's how God designed marriage. But sometimes we're not working as hard as we should. My beloved is mine and I am his, she said in chapter 2, 16. Then later, chapter 6, verse 3, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. You listen to that. Chapter 7, 10, I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me. Mutual love and harmony and communication. And that's what we need in every home. And the right atmosphere produces undying, indestructible harmony of hearts. The marital love of chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. But there can be an atmosphere of anger. Some homes have an atmosphere of anger. I grew up in a home like that. And so when you go through the door, if the angry person is there, everybody's walking on eggshell. I walked on eggshell for a long time. An atmosphere of abuse. The fear of what will this person say or do to me next. Can you understand that destroys harmonious love? We have to create an atmosphere. An atmosphere of intimidation does not promote harmonious love. You cannot intimidate. You cannot manipulate people. Be sincere with people. Be honest. Be open. Broken vows of marriage destroy harmonious love. Deceiving each other. An atmosphere of distrust and suspicion and constantly accusing and counter-accusing destroy the potential for harmonious love. Insecurity will destroy harmonious love. And so every one of us has the challenge of working and building that atmosphere of security and loyalty and fidelity and peace. And if we do it, we can have a happy, harmonious marriage. Set me as a seal upon you. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which have a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, would utterly be content. There is a beautiful, loyal, steadfast love designed by God. Keep the fire burning. Cultivate that love. This beautiful book celebrates the joy and security of committed love in marriage. I hope that we'll reflect upon this unusual book and the beautiful story that it tells, because we're part of that story. And then I hope we can learn to cultivate our love by lessons that we can gain studying the Song of Solomon. Now, the greatest gift of all is the gift of God's love in sending Christ, so that we have forgiveness of our sins. Sins we have committed against God, sins we have committed against our fellow man, maybe even our mate. But in John 3:16, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. We are created to be friends and companions of God forever. He wants to wash away our sins and give us the gift of heaven. But now we must be willing to receive the gift. He does not force us to love and serve Him. And so we read in Mark 16, verse 15, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. All the world must know the Savior has come. He that believeth," do you believe tonight the Savior has come? "He that believeth and is baptized," are you willing to submit to Christ in baptism? "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." Our sins can be washed away. But God is giving us a choice. "He that believeth not shall be damned." We choose heaven or we choose hell when we respond to the gospel of Christ. Saints will sometimes stumble and sin, and we need to know we can be restored to the favor and fellowship of God. In James 5:16, "Confess your faults one to another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much." When we're sick, we need the prayers of the saints. But when we stumble and sin, we need the prayers of the saints. And we're ready to help you tonight. If you need to be baptized into Christ, if you need to make confession of sins that are not by the brethren, children and in the community, why not make the correction that you need to make? Come and respond tonight while we stand and sing together.